Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Next up is Andrew Coburn. He's the author of Rumsfeld's Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy, and he now writes at Harper's Magazine, harpers.org, of course. Flying blind, the U.S. air power lobby, botched bombing missions, and bootless combat is the latest relevant and previously warthogs and all. The U.S. Air Force's foolish plan to scrap its most effective plane. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Andrew?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us. Now, I got a lawnmower right outside my window, so I'm going to try to leave my mic off and let you explain for a while here, and you do have a lot to talk about in these articles. I think a lot of people noticed that it seems strange that they were using B-1 bombers in order to bomb ISIS targets outside of Kobani last week. Some people were just impressed. Wow, a B-1. But it seemed to me, maybe it's not overkill, but maybe just the wrong mission altogether for a plane like that. And boy, you sure seem to think so.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's actually pretty ridiculous. You have to give a little bit of history here. The B-1 was originally conceived and sold as it was going to be a supersonic nuclear bomber that would race to Moscow and, you know, drop nuclear weapons on the Kremlin. That was actually back in the early 70s when they first touted it, and it had two functions. The official one was, as I said, to drop nuclear bombs on Moscow. Well, actually three. The second one was to, to fulfill the Air Force, U.S. Air Force, always has and always does and always will put its faith or, you know, rest its legitimacy on long-range bombers. That's what it likes to do because that way they're free and clear of, the pesky army and anyone else, and they can get more money that way. The third and maybe most important reason at the time, at least, was this B-1 was going to be built in California, and Richard Nixon wanted to sew up the California vote for his re-election in 1972, and then Gerald Ford wanted to do the same thing in 1976. So it was, in a sense, the Republican bomber. So as it happened, or as it so often happens, the B-1 turned out to be pretty much of a dog in terms of its design. It couldn't fly to Moscow supersonically. It would have run out of gas long before then. And it would almost certainly be shot down. So,
yeah, you write in here that it couldn't even make it over the Rocky Mountains with a full payload of bombs.
That's right. So they sort of recast it as a conventional bomber. And it was still a dog. And as you mentioned, as I say in my last piece in Flying Blind in Harper's Magazine, it can't even make it over the Rocky Mountains with a full load of bombs. And it has to be pretty careful going through the Rocky Mountains, too, because, you know, it's very unmaneuverable. It takes about half a mile to turn, so it can't exactly nip in and out of those mountain peaks. Has to go quite carefully. Nevertheless, the Air Force says this is an ideal weapon for assisting troops in combat on the ground. You know, the troops are in a firefight. They're hunkered down behind, you know, one set of bushes, and the Taliban or whoever a few hundred yards away behind another set of bushes, and the B-1 is ideal for, you know, picking out the enemy. You know, well, you know, the thing is, you know, 2 or 3 miles up at least, normally, and it's bombing by computer. You know, they can't see the enemy; they can barely see the ground, and you know, they're meant to be able to bomb with great accuracy from that height, hitting the right people and not the wrong people, who would be our troops. Well, as you can probably guess, it hasn't turned out that way. In fact, they left a trail of havoc and civilian casualties across Afghanistan. There was some, you know, in 2008 and 2009, there was some horrendous, what the Air Force likes to call CIVCAS incidents, where they basically blew a bunch of civilians to pieces. And one, I think it was 90 in one case, 120 in another. But the Air Force, you know, they continued on because it's a bomber and they love it. So we come to an incident that happened this last June, which sort of really shows the whole thing, which was a group of American soldiers were on a patrol, essentially, in Afghanistan. And there was a fairly routine deal, and high above, circulating in sort of five-mile circles, was a B-1. And it came toward the end of the day, and they were going towards where they expected to be picked up by helicopter. And someone started shooting at them. It wasn't any kind of big battle. It was just, maybe one or at the most two guys taking pot shots. So some of this group, in fact, five of them, sort of set off up a hill to try and, you know, get behind the people who were shooting at them. And meanwhile, they called up the B-1 and said, hey, you know, we're under attack. You know, can you help us out? It was getting dark by this time, and apologies for sounding a little bit technical, but soldiers on that kind of mission, these are special forces soldiers, they have an infrared beacon or strobe on their helmets, which gives off an infrared sort of flash, so that, you know, other people, most people can't see it, but someone wearing night vision goggles can. And that's very important because up in the B-1, they were looking to see, peering out their window, which is about 3 inches thick anyway, because it was built for a supersonic bomber, looking to see if they could spot who, you know, where the Americans were and where the enemy were. And they reported, but they said, well, we don't see any, of these flashes, and therefore, we're going to, you know, we'll drop the bomb where we see, you know, people firing. Flashes from gun, from muzzle, from people firing their weapons. So they duly dropped, 1,000 pounds of bombs and blew these five soldiers to pieces. And it turns out that, in fact, it was impossible for them to see friendly troops because their equipment that they had on the plane didn't allow them to see these infrared strobes. No one had bothered to tell them that. No one thought this was any big deal. And as a result, you had five dead Americans and a dead Afghan soldier was with them. Mm. I'm sorry to sort of go on at technical length about
it. No, I'm very happy that you have. No, it's an important story. I was hoping you'd tell the whole thing like that, for sure.
So, but what it tells us, I mean, what it shows us is how little the Air Force, in fact, you know, the military as a whole, really cares about what they are actually meant to be doing. You know, here's a very important thing, supporting troops on the ground. If, you know, assuming you have a war or have fighting, which, of course, we don't want, but assuming that's happening, you want to be able to protect, you know, American troops on the ground. And they designate this lumbering sort of piece of junk to do the job with predictable results, like the tragedy in June. And I think so. Before you say, well, it's just a sort of technical weapons thing, which I know you're not saying, it really points to a wider thing, which is what, you know, our defense system is really all about. Mm-hmm. And it's not about fighting in the most efficient way possible. It's about getting money for budgets, protecting your turf, doing down the other services, and, you know, to heck with the, with the poor stiffs on the ground.
Yeah, sure looks like that. And that's, you really get to the kind of the other side of that same story in your other article from back in January, which I forget if we talked about. I think we did talk about it at the time, but we can go back over the other side of this too on the other side of this break about the A-10 And here's a plane that's actually useful for this kind of mission, and they want nothing to do with it, with an exclamation point on their emphasis theirs. So we'll be right back with Andrew Coburn after this. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Got Andrew Coburn on the line. Flying Blind is his blog entry here, I think latest, at the Harper's blog. The U.S. Air Power Lobby, botched bombing missions and bootless combat. And so he's telling the story of a terrible friendly fire incident in Afghanistan from, I think you said just this June, is that right?
Yeah, just last June, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where a B-1 dropped, I guess, a JDAM, satellite-guided bomb, on some American Army soldiers on the ground because their infrared goggles didn't match the same wavelength as their infrared blinkers that should have warned them off. And so, in trusting the technology, they basically they turned their decision-making over to it. And they're bombing from so far away, they have no way to confirm with their own eyes, and so they don't, and kill their own guys. Which brings us again back to the war against the Islamic State on the outskirts of Kobani there, at this time, backing up Kurdish rebels. And I guess it must be American Special Forces with the laser pointers on the ground by now, helping to coordinate the air attacks there. But even then, still using these big bombers. But so that obviously gets to the question of the A-10, and so, oh, and I found another article from me here at Harper's, Tunnel Vision, will the Air Force kill its most effective weapon there? I know, well, there's a big discussion all about the incentives behind it and all that, but just for starters, what exactly is the status of the A-10? Did they kill it, or was it quote-unquote saved?
It's still hanging on by its wingtips. The Congress, actually, due to the Congress, who we don't think much of in many ways, but the fact that the Air Force is trying to get rid of something that, the one plane that really delivers and doesn't kill a lot of civilians and does, protect American troops on the ground, that somehow got through to the Congress thanks to a lot of, a lot of grassroots support. And so they voted overwhelmingly basically they said the Air Force couldn't spend any money on killing the A-10 this year, which,
can they buy more? And who makes them, by the way?
Well,
don't they have lobbyists?
Long gone out of production. The Air Force shut down the production line as soon as it possibly could.
Oh, okay.
Back in the 80s.
Haven't been making them for a long time, but they have been able to maintain them all this time.
Right, yeah, and they've upgraded them. They're still. I think we're down to about 250 of them now, and actually less. It's about 200, I think.
And now, for people not familiar, this is the one that has the gigantic-looking engines on the wings, and I don't know how else to describe it. I had a toy one, G.I. Joe, in the 1980s when I was a kid. It's the one that flies low and slow. Oh, and the pilot sits in a titanium bathtub, they call it. So you can fly right into combat, basically. Boots
the whole
in the
idea
air and
is,
blast them.
The whole idea was that he could fly close enough to the ground so to actually see what was going on. So, the pilot could actually see with his own eyes or else use binoculars to actually see what was happening. And to be able to do that, it had to be very, well protected against ground fire, which it is in all sorts of ways, including the famous titanium bathtub. And it had to be very maneuverable, which it also is. So it can fly slow, low and slow, which you need to be, so you're not sort of whizzing over the target and can't see what's going on. And therefore, you have to be very nimble, all of which it is. And it also had the other big feature is it has this very powerful cannon, which fires, so it can, fires very accurately is the point, rather than bombs, which are always prone to inaccuracy.
Right.
Anyway, the interesting thing about it, you think, well, that's great. You know, we're very good of them to have this weapon. The Air Force only bought it because they thought the Army was going to take the, you know, it was a budget competition with the Army. They thought the Army was going to take away that mission. So they built it. But the moment they got rid of the Army threat, they wanted to kill it because the Air Force hates, really hates the idea of spending precious time and dollars on protecting American soldiers when there's more interesting things to be done, like dropping nuclear bombs on Moscow. So they've done their best to kill it.
Yeah. Well, now, wait, so let's really dwell on that point for a minute there, because, you know, this point has been emphasized a lot of times by a lot of people, and I know you and your writing as well, but no, really, the Air Force really hates serving the Army. Never
yeah.
mind the individual soldiers down there, the individual GIs who need help right now. To them, the entire concept is, you know, the lowliest of janitorial work, and they would rather be Iran's Air Force than the Army's Air Force.
Yeah, well put. That's
and in fact, they're back in the Quds Force, and they're front men in Iraq right now, so maybe that's a perfectly apt analogy.
Yeah. So they, that's it. And the reason, you know, they think like that is because, you know, years ago, the Air Force was born. It was just part of the Army, you know, like the artillery or something. And they hated that. They hated it. So they fought for and got their independence. And they got their independence. Their big argument was, we can win wars on our own, you know. No need to have the Army, you know, doing mucking around in the mud and things like that. We can bomb the enemy's sort of heartland and cause him to surrender, and, you know, that's all you need. So give us lots of money, please. Well, they promised that in, you know, in World War II. It didn't work. They promised it in Korea. It didn't work. They promised it, you know, you can go on and on. It never worked. But, of course, in the meantime, they get to receive and spend a lot of money. So they're very popular in, you know, with industry and the Congress. Mm-hmm. So that's really how the game is played.
Well, now, is there any pressure in the Army to say, well, just give us the damn planes and we'll fly them and you guys can go off and do your, you know, pretend that you'll ever be in a dogfight again when you're really bombing civilians in their own countries all day. And we'll just have the A-10s to back us up since you don't want the job.
Well, in a sane world, of course, that would happen. The problem is, back in 1947, I think it was, the Army, there was a famous thing called the Key West Agreements, where the services all sort of signed treaties with each other as to who would do what. And they promised not to poach on each other's missions. And the Army promised not to fly any fixed-wing combat aircraft. And, you know, the Army is always kind of the wuss in these affairs. They always get beaten out in the big budget fights and so forth. And
but the Navy gets F-18s. It's not fair.
Yeah. The Navy gets F-18s. The Marines have, you know, we have three air forces. You know, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines. But the poor old Army still sort of staggers along, marches along, limps along.
Right.
And they've never had the guts to really stand up and say, we demand, you know, we want those A-10s, which they obviously should do.
Mm.
Because they now have a big helicopter lobby. And so lots of people's careers and retirements and everything are hooked into the...
Although,
you know,
I think we learned in Iraq War II that those Apaches and Cobras are basically useless in battle against men with just shoulder-fired weapons.
Right, they're quite good.
They call them right out of battle quickly.
Right, you're exactly right. We saw in that, you know, famous WikiLeaks video, we saw that the Apache is quite good at sort of shooting a bunch of civilians in the street, but in an actual battle against, you know, ground defenses, it's completely useless. In fact, they've lost, I gather that in these recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they've lost about 50 Apaches, which is quite a lot. To people firing with not very sophisticated weapons.
A surprising amount. Wow, yeah, I didn't realize it was that high.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation. So going back to your original question about did the A-10 get saved, it's saved for the time being. And the Air Force is obviously grinding its teeth. I mean, they're rather a vindictive crew, the present sort of leadership of the Air Force, and they don't like you know, they had this big plan to get rid of it, and, you know, because everything's going to be done by this incredible dog they're building, the F-35. And they promised that would do everyone's job, and the Congress stopped them. So they'll probably try again next year. So we're not home free.
Right. Yeah, and F-35, of course, has all the exact same problems as the B-2. It's going too fast to do the job well. Simple as that. It's going too fast.
It can't maneuver. And, oh, it gets worse. It goes downhill from there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's just for starters. It starts with couldn't possibly and then gets worse. Yeah, well.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is. It's an absolute mess. And by the way, no one should misinterpret any of this as a celebration of strafing or anything like that. It's a narrower point we're talking about here, the dysfunction of the military and the empire and the way it all works, of course.
Exactly.
Just so everyone's clear on that. And I really wanted to get Patrick on the show to talk about the war today, too, but he was busy doing a debate. But anyway, he may be on the show tomorrow. But thanks again for your time, Andrew. It's great to talk to you
okay,
again.
Okay, you're welcome. Take care, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Andrew Coburn. He's at harpers.org. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there.